Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much effort does it take to be physically fit, and how can we be sure we're doing what our bodies really need? As new scientific evidence of the benefits of exercise continues to accumulate, there is no doubt we need to keep moving or get moving in order to be physically and mentally healthy. But as my guest today has learned by tracking these new developments, a lot of the old advice many of us are still following may be leading us in the wrong direction. Gretchen Reynolds writes the Phys Ed column for the New York Times. Her new book is called The First 20 Minutes: Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, Live Longer. Gretchen, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
You characterize this book as a sort of owner's manual for the human body, and reading through it, it becomes clear that the owner's manuals many of us are already carrying around in our heads are way outdated.
Yes, and that includes the owner's manual that I was following until I started doing all of this research. I mean, most of us learned sort of back in elementary school, we learned from PE classes many of the precepts that we still follow in our workouts today, and science has moved on since then.
So we've all been following the Olympics this weekend and obsessing over these people who spend hours exercising every day. In that light, when you talk about 20 minutes, it seems to be setting the bar pretty low. First of all, what do we know about how much exercise most Americans are getting right now?
Oh, the amount that most Americans are getting is extremely minimal. In fact, a third of Americans get zero exercise at all. And it's probably actually more than that. And the percentage of Americans who get even 20 to 30 minutes a day, which is the lowest recommended amount, is very small. And even the people who get some exercise don't exercise every day, or just all people who do exercise then sit the whole rest of the day. So fundamentally, Americans move very, very little.
So the whole thing, the research on sitting is really interesting, and I think in this culture where a lot of us sit at a computer all day is terrifying. Talk about what happens to the body when we sit for a prolonged period of time.
This is actually one of the most interesting areas of exercise science, I think. What we are learning is that sitting is one of the most unhealthy things that you can do in terms of keeping your body healthy. What science is finding is that Americans, as I said, sit a lot, and that includes people who exercise. There is this entire phenomenon called the active couch potato, which most of us are, and again, including myself. Those are people who dutifully exercise every day. We go out and we run, walk, do something at lunch or in the morning. We then sit the entire rest of the day. Mm-hmm. And what scientists are finding is uninterrupted sitting, even if you exercise at one stretch during the day, is extremely unhealthy. And what happens is that the big muscles in your legs and your back are not contracting. Then you get less of an enzyme that breaks up fat in the bloodstream. You have a buildup of fat. That has to go somewhere. It goes to the heart. It goes to the liver. It goes to the muscles. You also have more blood sugar circulating because your muscles are not using it. So sitting for long stretches of time is believed to contribute to heart disease and diabetes, even if you work out once in a while.
So you don't buy yourself 4 hours of movie time just by working out for 45 minutes in the morning?
No. Unfortunately, there's very clear evidence, particularly in men, but also in women, that even people who work out every day, if they sit uninterrupted for about 8 hours in an uninterrupted stretch, they have a considerably increased risk of heart disease and of diabetes.
So conversely, standing up for just a couple of minutes at a time, a few times an hour, tends to erase a lot of that damage.
Yes, that's the good news. The good news is that the problems related to sitting are among the easiest to combat because all you have to do is not sit. And the science is pretty clear that if you stand up about every 20 minutes, And you don't have to do much. Just stand up. You don't have to jog in place. You don't have to do anything. If you stand up, maybe stretch your arms, just do anything, then those muscles are contracting. They start breaking up the fat. You start using the blood sugar. And there's pretty clear evidence that standing about every 20 minutes does reduce the risk for diabetes and heart disease, and it uses calories.
Hmm.
There have been some very interesting studies showing that people who stand up more tend to have less risk for obesity, and they burn more calories over the course of the day. And that's all you do is stand up.
So at the very least, stand up when you could be sitting.
I'm standing up right now.
Yeah, I read that you're doing your interviews for this book standing. And it's funny because I do a lot of sitting and reading as preparation for this job, not so different from you probably researching mm-hmm. and writing. And it occurred to me that about every 20 minutes I want to check my email or check my Facebook. And so now I've decided I'm going to stand up when I do those things.
I have mentioned this before, but I bought a very inexpensive music stand that I keep in my office.
Mm-hmm.
I put papers on it so I can read them standing up. They're very simple and inexpensive things that you can do that allow you to set up your office or your home so that you're standing up more. And that's enough to start living more healthfully.
I did have an instant thought reading about all this standing and sitting research of my kids who were in school all day and constantly being told to sit back down.
Yes. The science would seem to suggest that what we're telling kids about sitting still is not helpful. There have been a couple of small studies that have found that more frequent, even very short recess breaks that amount to virtually nothing more than standing up, maybe walking down the hall, help kids to focus better and actually perform better on math tests. So I've talked to the teachers at my son's school, and they are actually going to have the kids up and moving more often than they have been.
Okay, Gretchen, so let's say we decide we are going to commit ourselves to that first 20 minutes that is the most valuable and that you get a lot of benefit from. How hard do we need to go during those 20 minutes?
Not particularly hard. And the first thing I should clarify is the first 20 minutes really of movement, of any kind of movement, confers the most health benefits. And that means that if you get up off the couch and start moving in anyway, walking is the easiest, the cheapest, the thing that humans are best at, but gardening, cooking, vacuuming, any type of movement, in 20 minutes of that will start reducing your risk for diabetes, heart disease, dementia, high blood pressure, the real ills of modern living. It will make you healthier.
Mm-hmm.
What it won't necessarily do is make you a lot more physically fit, which is actually a different thing. Health generally means that you're free of disease, that mm-hmm. you're capable of doing what you want to do. If you want to run a 5K, then you're going to have to go somewhat harder. You will probably need to walk very briskly for those 20 minutes, and you will get faster, you will get more fit. If your primary goal is to live a long, productive life and be free of most diseases, including cancer, there's very good evidence that 20 minutes of walking may be all that you need to do.
And what about, you just had a piece this last week in the Times, you can actually break that 20 minutes up into, say, two 10-minute chunks.
Yes, isn't that nice? What we keep finding, which this may be an indication of how difficult it is to get people to adhere to exercise. But scientists do keep looking for the least amount that we can do.
It's the American way, right?
Yes, I'm afraid so. We have the two extremes. We have the Olympians and the people who aren't doing anything. But there is a growing body of evidence that you do not even have to do your quote-unquote exercise in one block in order to get significant health benefits. The study that I wrote about last week looked at high blood pressure and found that two or three 10-minute blocks of walking were not only as effective, but actually more effective at controlling blood pressure than one 30-minute walk. So if you don't have time to go walk at lunchtime, 3 periods during the day and walk for 10 minutes. 2 times during the day for 10 minutes is you're definitely going to get more benefit than if you don't do anything.
Now, how hard do we have to go to, how much does our heart rate have to be increased? How hard do we have to be breathing for that to really have a health impact for us?
The bulk of the science would suggest that a quote-unquote brisk walk is sufficient. And in that case, it's a somewhat relative definition. It means you need to be feeling that you're moving.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely need to be breathing somewhat hard. Be honest with yourself. Pick a range from like 1 to 10 of what feels really uncomfortable, with 10 being, for most people, a pretty hard run.
Mm-hmm.
If your walking feels like at least a 5 to 6 on that scale, you are going to be getting health and fitness benefits. Even if you do it for 5 minutes, or 10 minutes, 20 minutes, a brisk walk appears to be just the sweet zone for exercise benefits.
So what did you learn, Gretchen, about the importance of specialized shoes in particular? You know, now there's very expensive walking and running shoes out there. You can spend a lot of money. Do we need special shoes?
The answer to that is no, unless that's what will get you out and doing something.
If your motivation is the fancy shoes, then go for it.
Yeah, for some people, if they've just spent $100 on shoes, they'll stick to it.
Mm-hmm.
The human body is very clearly built to walk. We are very good as a species at walking. We're actually much better at walking than at running. When they bring both humans and other mammals into the lab and test them on treadmills, most other mammals are much more efficient at running than we are.
Mm-hmm.
We do better than almost any other species on Earth at walking. So there's very little that you need to invest in to be a perfectly capable walker. You don't generally need fancy shoes. You need a shoe that is comfortable, that feels good when you put it on, and that you'll just wear and go out and do it. If that means it's your wingtips, you probably are not going to hurt yourself. If you wear something and it feels good walking, you're golden. Go ahead and stick with it. Running is a slightly different issue, and that's probably because there's some evidence that we're not necessarily great runners. There's a very high incidence of running injury among people, and that may be the result of shoes. That's not completely clear, but some people have found that if they take their shoes off, if they run barefoot, they are less prone to injury. We'll get phone calls about that. The bigger problem is many people have been taking off their shoes and running barefoot and then getting injured.
Hmm.
And that seems to be because all of us grew up wearing shoes.
Hmm.
And your entire body does adapt to wearing shoes. Every muscle, every tendon, every joint in your legs will be adapted to moving in shoes. And if you take them off, then all of that becomes unadapted, and it's very common to get injured.
Gretchen Reynolds is with us. She writes the Phys Ed column for the New York Times. We're talking about her new book, The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, Live Longer. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gretchen Reynolds. She writes the phys ed column for the New York Times, and she's the author of a new book called The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, Live Longer. Join this conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Gretchen, as you might imagine, we're pretty sanguine about the heat here in Texas, but it is, as we speak today, 99 degrees right now, and we're nowhere near the hottest point of the day. What do we need to keep in mind about exercising when it is very hot outside?
The primary thing, and this is just unequivocal in all of the scientific literature, is you just have to adapt slowly. Mm-hmm. If you are going to run or otherwise work out outside, to some degree it's common sense, try and do it obviously in the morning or the evening when it's much, much cooler. If that's not possible and you do need to work out in the afternoon, maybe at lunch, and you have to do it outside, you really have to acclimate slowly because the body does have to become used to sweating more. The heart works more when it's really hot. You need to probably back off at least 10 to 20% from what you would normally do. And it usually takes about 10 days is the commonly accepted number of days it takes to acclimate to the heat. So give yourself, take it easy. I mean, for the first few days that you work out in the heat, go slower, go for a shorter period of time, drink a lot of water. There's not evidence, by the way, that being dehydrated will contribute to heat problems in exercisers, but it's always a good idea to be drinking enough that you feel comfortable.
What are the differences between how men sweat and how women sweat?
Well, that's actually an area that remains controversial. There definitely is a difference. Men do sweat more. They tend to sweat in different places than women do. They actually cool off better than women do. But women have smaller total body mass, so they don't get as hot. Hmm. So men and women who are working out together in the heat, the man will sweat a lot more, which allows him to actually cool off more, but he also gets hotter. So it's something of a trade-off, who is better adapted to working out in the heat. The primary answer to that is none of us are really good at working out in the heat. If you can avoid it, do. If you can't, one other thing that's been proven to help somewhat if you're working out in the heat, have a slushie at least 10 minutes beforehand. Hmm. It does seem to lower core body temperature, which will allow you to work out safely, probably a little longer.
And have a frozen banana on hand?
Yes, that would be good. Also, if you can have a frozen towel to drape around your neck, mm-hmm. that can help also.
And cramping is a problem for some people when they exercise. And it turns out that people talk about drinking pickle juice, and this is not some commercial product. This is actual pickle juice.
Yes, pickle juice drained from a jar of Vlasic. This is an instance when trainers, particularly for football teams, had started doing something before the science caught up to it, mm-hmm. and it has turned out that they were right. It appears that drinking pickle juice, as I said, just drained from a jar of pickles, in just a small amount, a couple of ounces, once you have a cramp has started, if you're carrying pickle juice with you, which, of course, we're all doing, right? if you can drink it immediately, it appears that the pickle juice is very effective at stopping the process that results in the cramp. It does appear able to stop the cramping.
Is it the salt? Is it the vinegar? Is it the garlic?
It appears to be the acidity, although it's not completely clear because it happens very quickly. It happens before the pickle juice could actually get out of your stomach. Hmm. So it seems to be that the central nervous system recognizes that you've ingested something and responds very quickly and stops sending the signals that are causing the cramping. And it has been found to be quite effective.
So I confess I never liked being on the bandwagon with the 8 glasses of water a day, no matter what, and twice that if you're exercising advice. And it turns out we can, for the most part, drink to satisfy our thirst and be pretty safe.
Yes, that's another instance when science was a little bit behind common sense. Many of us who ran marathons, say, 10, 20 years ago, were told that we had to stay ahead of our thirst, that you had to drink constantly, that you should drink before your workout, during workout, after workout. It turns out it's not helpful, that it actually can be counterproductive. You actually can overdrink, which is quite dangerous. And in fact, the human thirst mechanism is just exquisitely well-tuned to telling you how much you need to drink. So if you listen to your thirst, for almost all of us, that's the best signal to drink more. If you're not thirsty, you don't need to drink. If you are thirsty, you should. And water is ideal.
So, Gretchen, what about powering up for a workout, recovering after a workout? It sounds like a lot of us are not working out enough to really need special foods.
Yes, that includes me, unfortunately. If you're not working out for more than about an hour and vigorously, so be honest with yourself. If you're running for an hour, then you will have depleted most of the fuel stores in your muscles. Then you need to probably have some sort of fuel, which means carbohydrates, during your exercise. That can be a sports drink. It can be a banana. There was a study that just came out showing bananas provided quicker fuel during a workout than sports drinks did. It also means if you have exercised to that extent, then when you're done, you're going to have some small amount of muscle damage. That's actually the point of that kind of exercise. You overload, and then the muscles adapt and become stronger and more fit. They will do that better if you have some sort of food right afterwards that contains carbohydrates and protein. And it turns out, scientifically proven, one of the best recovery beverages is chocolate milk.
Wow.
It's one of the reasons that I, at least once a week, try to exercise more strenuously. So I earn chocolate milk.
Well, I guess it makes sense. It's got a little bit of sugar. It's got certainly protein. And I guess, are you talking about low-fat milk here?
Low-fat chocolate milk. Mm-hmm. The ratio of carbohydrates to protein, just for whatever reason, is almost ideal in terms of helping you to replace the calories that you've lost, to replace the fuel in your muscles, and also to give the muscles the protein they need to recover better. There have been studies that have found, and I'm not in any way paid by the Chocolate Milk Foundation or anything, but there have been a number of very credible studies that found that athletes who had chocolate milk after strenuous workouts actually became more fit and had lower body fat around their middle than athletes that just had a sports drink. So if you're going to have something afterwards, if you've worked out for an hour or so, then go with chocolate milk or a yogurt or something that has both carbohydrates and protein.
Now, we pay a lot of attention, Gretchen, to what endurance athletes eat the night before a big competition, maybe the morning of. It turns out it matters almost as much, if not more, what they're consuming during that extended activity.
Yes. What's interesting is, again, the more scientists study some of this, the more many of the things that we once believed were upended. There's not a lot of good evidence to show that carbo-loading, which, again, those of us who ran marathons back in the day, were all told to carbo-load, to eat tons of pasta in the days before a race. Well, that actually, especially if you were a woman, can be counterproductive because all those carbohydrates that get packed into your muscles also pull a lot of water into the muscles. You wind up weighing more. And women put even more water in, so you wind up at the starting line of a race weighing a lot, weighing more than you should. And that weight you have to carry over the course of the course. So that's not helpful. What is helpful is to eat a normal diet basically up until you exercise, and then if you are exercising, again, for at least an hour, to have carbohydrates during your exercise, that will fuel you to go farther, to do more and harder exercise. But again, it doesn't have to be some sort of fancy gel. It doesn't even have to be a sports drink. Have a banana if you can stomach it. Have a packet of peanuts. Anything that feels that feels comfortable when you eat it, that you can digest well, will work, especially if it's high in carbohydrates.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We're speaking with Gretchen Reynolds, author of The First 20 Minutes. Let's go on the phone now to David in Garland. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
Hey, I was wondering, as you know, it's really hot here, even in the mornings, and I wear a chest strap to measure my heart rate, and it goes way up when it's hot. Am I burning more calories, or is it helping when it's hot and the heart rate goes up?
You probably are not burning more calories, but you are definitely stressing your system more. There's very good evidence that heart rate will increase in exercise in the heat. That I don't know that it's been measured, the effect that that has on calories, but it does mean that you are stressing yourself quite a bit more, and it's a really good idea to go easier until your body fully adapts to that. It might sound great to think that you're burning more calories, but really what you're doing is causing more stress to your body than is probably advisable. You'll get more benefit in general in terms of your health and your fitness with less risk of injury if you back off a little bit and see how your heart adjusts. Within 10 days, even in heat, it should be back to pretty much the same range as it was in before. If not, you might even want to speak with a sports medicine specialist and just check on whether, you know, the workout is advisable.
A lot of people, in order to prevent injuries, Gretchen, particularly before a run, are almost religious about stretching. And this is something that they might want to rethink.
Yes, that's probably the most controversial thing I've ever written about is stretching. All of us, at least everyone I know, was brought up to stretch before a workout, especially a vigorous one, especially a race. And by stretching, meaning bending over, touching your toes, holding that pose, leaning up against a wall, pushing so that you're stretching hamstrings, all of that. Well, there's pretty good evidence that that actually is counterproductive in terms of performance and injury prevention, because it appears that the brain thinks that you are about to actually overstretch that muscle and sends out what they call an inhibitory response, which makes the muscle less able to contract. So you actually can jump less high, you can run less fast, you're possibly more prone to injury after a bout of static stretching, which is what that type of stretching is known as, than if you don't do anything at all.
But warming up is still a good idea.
Warming up is still a good idea, especially if you literally warm up the tissues. That makes them more pliable. It makes them more able to work with the joints, so you have range of motion. And it's generally poor joint range of motion that leads to injury. So if you can jump, if you're going to go for a run, if you can slowly walk, if you can actually raise the temperature in the tissues that are going to be working a lot, then that appears to be the best way to avoid injury and to improve performance.
Do we need to cool down at the end and sort of go a little slower but keep moving?
You would think so, but there's actually virtually no scientific proof showing that a cool down is important in terms of preventing injury. If you like to cool down, that's great. If you haven't been injured and you've been cooling down, keep it up. If you've never cooled down, don't feel that you have to, because they've done a number of studies showing people who cool down don't get injured. People who don't cool down don't get injured. So it's very variable.
And if we really do love stretching, just we can do it after the workout.
Certainly. There was one interesting study where they took runners and had some of them who were used to stretching stop, and almost all of them thought they had become injured, although when doctors actually checked, it wasn't true. But the people were so dedicated to their stretching routine that it really disrupted their enjoyment of exercise. So if you are stretching beforehand now, it doesn't mean you have to stop. It just means you probably are not getting out of it what you think you are. And it would probably be better if you moved it to after exercise.
Are there some sports where you're actually better off not being super flexible?
Running. Mm-hmm. There's extremely good evidence that tight hamstrings make you a faster runner. They also increase your risk for injury. But Kenyan runners have some of the tightest hamstrings on earth. And that's because a really tight ligament or the tissues returns more energy. It's like having a really taut rubber band.
Yeah.
If you stretch it and let it go, it goes really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So having very tight hamstrings actually will make you a faster runner. It also will make you more prone to injury. It's a real knife edge of what's healthy and what isn't. But for runners, having really loose tendons and ligaments is not necessarily desirable.
Let's go to the phones now. We have a question from Stuart in Dallas. Hi, Stuart.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering about, you were talking about stretching and how it has a negative impact on performance, but I was wondering what you thought of ballistic stretching, where you're keeping your heart rate up and you're not exactly performing the same static movements that would normally be negative.
Well, I'm not quite sure how you're defining ballistic stretching. Do you mean like sitting on the ground and really rapidly stretching, you know, up and down and up and down?
Yeah, exactly, where you're more, it's more of a cardio workout before mm-hmm. your actual workout, where your muscles are snapping back and forth.
You know what, let me have you pause right there, Gretchen, before you answer, because mm-hmm. we need to take a quick break. My guest is Gretchen Reynolds. She writes the Phys Ed column for the New York Times, and she's got a new book out called The First 20 Minutes. Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, Live Longer. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Gretchen Reynolds. She writes for the New York Times. She's got the Phys Ed column there, and she's got a new book out called The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, Live Longer. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. And Gretchen, before the break, we heard from Stuart, who had this question about the value of stretching while we are moving and exercising.
What he had mentioned was ballistic stretching, which got a very bad name probably 10, 15 years ago when people decided that it increased your risk of pulling a muscle. Ballistic stretching is where you might lean over and sort of bounce.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that scientists are finding that ballistic stretching is probably better than static stretching because it does not lead to the quote-unquote inhibitory response from the nervous system. But neither is as good as dynamic stretching, which really means warming up by moving, by doing sort of a lighter version of whatever you're going to be doing, walking before you start to actually run. If you're going to be playing tennis, do some jumping jacks because that helps to warm up the shoulder muscles to increase your range of motion. Do something that mimics what you're going to be doing that really warms up the tissues. And they usually call that dynamic stretching.
How important is it for most of us to work on balance?
Very, very important, particularly those of us who are no longer 20. You do start to lose or degrade your sense of proprioception, which is your sense of how your body is positioned in space, that really starts to become worse as you age, and that begins in your 30s. So it's really important to work on balance in order to reduce your risk of injury, in order to age well, in order to not fall over and embarrass yourself. And it's another instance where it's really quite easy to do that, to work that into your daily life. I do it by standing on one leg when I brush my teeth.
So you just do it for a minute and then you switch to the other leg? Is that basically it?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And for someone who finds it really easy, you don't have to do it while you brush your teeth. It's just, I spoke with a man who's an expert on balance training who said that they tell all of their patients, do it when you brush your teeth because you have to be doing it anyway. So you think about it. If you can stand there with one leg held up for, you know, minutes at a time, then you have good balance. Now try shutting your eyes and see how good you are at it. The first time I did that, I fell right into a wall. I'm better now.
Yeah, so how long did it take for you to improve?
Oh, I would say it took me at least a month of standing on one leg pretty regularly. And I had no sense that my balance was impaired.
Yeah.
But when I first tried to stand on one leg with my eyes closed, it was really poor.
You know, all of this research is fascinating for those of us at whatever age we are. But the idea of being active into our senior years is really appealing because it has to do not only with physical fitness, but with all the entire quality of life that people have.
One of the most encouraging aspects of exercise science for me is the growing finding that many of the aspects of aging that we had thought were inevitable, that were basically defined as aging, may be due more to being inactive. Things like losing a lot of muscle mass. You will lose some muscle mass no matter what, but you will lose so much less if you remain physically active, even to the extent of just walking and maybe doing push-ups a couple of times a week. That's all you need to do. You will slow the loss of muscle mass so quickly. You will increase your ability to be independent well into your 80s or 90s, and it requires so little investment of time and effort.
So at least in this country, many people begin an exercise program with the goal of losing weight. That doesn't really happen unless they change their diets and then they quit. What do we know about exercise and weight loss?
What we know seems to be changing all the time. What seems very clear is that exercise, if you do not change your diet, will not generally lead to much weight loss. And that seems to be because many people who start to exercise, even at a fairly low level, and that does include walking, often find that their appetite increases and they eat more. We were talking about chocolate milk. If you go for a walk, a 30-minute walk, and have a glass of chocolate milk, you have just taken in more calories than you burned. So, and weight loss really does come down. There's no magic. It does come down to calories in, calories out. Exercise, if you don't control your diet, can, in many people, actually lead to weight gain. And I say that as a person who loves exercise. But you have to be realistic. If you start exercising only to lose weight and you don't control your diet, then you will become healthier, you will become more fit, you will not necessarily become skinnier.
Now, you actually worked with the folks at the Cooper Aerobic Center that's located here in Dallas to learn about this, the whole fat and fit phenomenon. Can you talk about that?
Yes. In fact, the Cooper Institute has done just phenomenal work about what it means to be fat and or fit and which is more important or which is healthier. And what they have shown really definitively is that being fit is the most important thing you can do for your longevity and your quality of life. And that means that you have what is in technical terms called a healthy VO2 max, or that means an ability to get oxygen to your muscles, it really means that you can walk around the block well, that you can comfortably walk or run or jog for 30 minutes. If you can do that, it doesn't seem to matter if you're overweight. You will still live longer than someone who is quite thin and is not fit. So if you have trouble losing weight, but you are walking 30 minutes a day, relax. You actually are probably better off than someone who's not walking, even if they are more thin.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Lore, who is from South Carolina, I guess driving through Texas. Hi, Lore.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This has been really interesting. I am 65, and I am not somebody that loves exercise, but I appreciate what your guest was saying. I'm just doing it because I know it's really important. The only thing I can make myself do, I mean, that I've been able to do, is I walk on my treadmill, and it's up on an incline, so I'm doing that. It's been kind of... But if I go too fast, I have deteriorated discs and all that kind of stuff. So I find that I go slowly, and if I'm doing 20 minutes, I'm trying to do it every day, but at least every other day, but it's only like 2.3 miles an hour. Is that beneficial?
Yes. in a word, first of all, without being facetious, any activity that someone does is more beneficial than no activity. There is a pervasive myth that if you can't go out and run for 30 minutes, then you're not getting anything out of exercise. That's just not true, and demonstrably not true. But the routine that you're talking about is actually very beneficial. There's clear evidence that any amount of walking over about 4 minutes does reduce your risk for the diseases. It reduces your risk for gaining weight. It's good for the heart. If you can't comfortably go any faster than that, then stick with what you're doing. There is no doubt at all that it is beneficial in terms of reducing the risk for disease and increasing longevity.
Why is it so good for your brain?
Yeah, that's my favorite aspect of exercise science today. This is another case where most of us were brought up being told that we had a certain number of brain cells and we were born with as many as we would ever have, and then we'd then spend the rest of our lives killing them off with fear.
Yeah.
It's not true. Everyone, every human continues to make new brain cells throughout his or her life. But if you exercise, the evidence is very strong that you will create two or three times as many new brain cells. And you create them in the area of the brain that's related to learning and memory. So people who exercise, and most of the work has been done on the equivalent of 20 to 30 minutes of walking most days of the week, people who do that perform much better on tests of memory in their 60s and 70s than people who don't exercise. And the portion of the brain that deals with memory and learning is larger than in people who do not walk.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Michael on the line in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hello. Listening to her, I've come up with more questions.
Just give me your favorite one, if you would. We're running low on time.
Well, it's about... lifting weights, and I've heard that if you build muscle, then the muscle will burn more calories while you're just even resting. And I'm wondering, I know you need protein. Do you need the protein before you work out, after you work out, or do you need to have some protein in there while you're working out? That's basically it.
Thanks.
And it's a question that is still being studied, but the consensus among scientists who've looked at weight training is, first of all, you do burn slightly more calories from a pound of muscle than a pound of fat. They're not a huge amount, but it does increase your metabolism. There's also some evidence that you will build more muscle after a weight training session if you have some protein afterwards, not before. But if that's not feasible, as long as you have protein at some point during the day, the muscles can certainly take advantage of that protein and will use it. It's most effective if you do it afterwards. And again, there have been studies of low-fat chocolate milk in people who were trying to build muscle, and it was quite effective.
Gretchen, do most studies of exercise physiology these days separate the results and sort of compare and contrast women versus men?
No. I wish they did. It's actually an issue that needs to be addressed far more than it is, and I say that as a woman, because women and men do not respond to exercise in exactly the same way. And that's because we have a lot more estrogen than men, and men have a lot more testosterone than we do. And when they have actually done experiments where they have given the other gender, where they've given men estrogen and they've given women testosterone, they have found that the women will respond more like men and the men will respond more like women. And so just having one gender in a study does limit the applicability of the results. And all of us, one thing I'd really like people to bear in mind is that all of us do respond differently to exercise sessions. If you start a routine with a training partner, one of you may lose more weight, become more fit, enjoy it more than the other person, but both of you will undoubtedly be healthier and more fit at the end. So don't quit if you don't respond as quickly as your husband or cousin.
And the last thing I want to ask you about is are there ways that people can get exercise throughout the day that they may not recognize are exercise, but that count toward overall basic health and fitness?
Any steps that you take during the day, I mean literally steps. If you walk down the hall to talk to your colleague instead of texting him, that counts. If you go up the stairs instead of taking the elevator. I mean, some of these things are so obvious and we still ignore them. Any type of movement that you do during the day will count towards improving your health and your fitness. There actually is some evidence that fidgeting, people who fidget more than other people can burn up to 200 calories more a day, and they actually have a higher VO2 max. They are more physically fit than people who don't. So I've told my husband to stop telling me to sit still.
Gretchen Reynolds writes the Phys Ed column for the New York Times, and she's author of the book The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, Live Longer. Gretchen, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast all online at kera.org. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.